friendships with Yoko Ono and Mick Jagger, the heady feeling of things like owning a penthouse suite in the San Remo in Manhattan, and attention from Time and Rolling Stone and Playboy confirmed that he had left his prosaic middle-class upbringing in the suburbia of Northern California far behind. When he started Next, he had for a brief time courted the press to help give his startup a boost. But by the mid-90s, playing up his celebrity held little appeal to Jobs. While he craved recognition for the quality of his work, he didn't desire fame in and of itself. He directed Katie Cotton, his communications chief at Apple, to adopt a policy in which Steve made himself available only to a few print outlets, including Fortune, The Wall Street Journal, Time, Newsweek, Business Week, and The New York Times. Whenever he had a product to hawk, he and Cotton would decide which of this handful of trusted outlets would get the story, and Steve would tell it, alone. Steve and I talked many times about his reluctance to share the spotlight with the others on his team, since I asked repeatedly to speak with them and was largely unsuccessful. Sometimes he'd aver that he didn't want anyone to know who was doing great work at Apple, since he didn't want them to get recruited by other companies. That was disingenuous, since Silicon Valley was an incestuous place where tech talent was tracked as closely as the stock market. What was true was that Steve didn't think anyone else could tell the story of his product or his company as well as he could. Steve was a great performer in any setting, and he considered most interviews to be just another performance. He was a terrific, extemporaneous thinker and talker, always confident that he could make the most of an opportunity to promote the company. He cared intensely about the look of any article he participated in, because he thought that photography and typography and a stylish layout helped convey the import of whatever message he wanted to get across. Under Steve's guidance, Apple would develop one of the clearest brand identities in the world. So, while Steve's policy irked some members of his core team, it was hard to argue with his success. Working for Steve meant accepting a whole range of idiosyncratic behaviors. Policies that seemed selfish often turned out to be good for the company. Strategies that at first appeared quixotic might well prove far-sighted. The members of Steve's core team learned to anticipate and live with his unpredictability. They knew they were working for someone special. Steve made sure, in his own way, that they knew he thought they were outstanding as well. Sometimes he'd ask one of them to join him on a long walk, whether around the Apple campus or near his home in Palo Alto. Those walks mattered, Ruby remembers. You'd think to yourself, Steve is a rock star. So getting quality time felt like an honor in some ways. Steve also compensated his key employees richly, arranging lucrative long-term contracts loaded with stock options for everyone in the inner circle. He was really good at surrounding himself with really good people and motivating them both philosophically and financially. You have to have the right mix. You have to provide just enough financial motivation in there so that people don't just say, "Fuck you, I'm not taking this anymore." Steve also understood that the personal satisfaction of accomplishing something insanely great was the best motivation of all for a group as talented as his. You had to believe that it was going to take some time, that you weren't going to wake up tomorrow morning and it was all going to be fixed, Tavanian once told me, and that 2 years, 3 years down the road, you were going to look back and say, "Gee, we got through it." If you didn't believe that, you were sunk. Because there was a lot of pain along the way. There were a lot of people saying it's going to fail. It's not going to work. This is wrong with it. That's wrong with it. Finding a million things wrong. But you just had to know that if you kept your head down, kept working, kept trying to do the right things, it would work out. Saving Apple was an accomplishment everyone on the team would take pride in for the rest of their lives. He cared deeply, says Rubenstein, and that made him a great manager when things weren't going well. At the beginning of this time at Apple, it was such a pleasure because we were all in it together. When it was tough, Avi adds, he'd think carefully about all the decisions. He'd think through the impact of everything, very carefully. While Steve never hesitated to emphatically assert his opinion, sometimes his fretting would drive the group crazy, as he delayed important projects by fussing endlessly over minute considerations, such as whether to change the plug connectors for mice and keyboards. Mike Slade, the head of marketing for a brief period at Next, went back to work at Apple in 1998 as a consultant to Steve. "People want to paint him like he's Michelangelo, you know," says Slade. "But he was a real nervous Nelly, like an old-fashioned, tiny, old, small businessman saying, 'Shall I cut another nickel off it?' Like a junk merchant." His attention to the job at hand was intense, and he set up his schedule to ensure that each of his key deputies was equally focused. Every Monday morning at 9 o'clock, he convened the executive team, the ET as it came to be known, in a conference room located in Building 1 of the Apple campus. Attendance was required. Referring to an agenda he himself had written up and distributed, he'd go around the table asking specific questions about projects under development and getting updates from the team. Each person was expected to be fully prepared for any question he might ask about their area of responsibility. For some, like Fred Anderson or Nancy Heinen, the general counsel, this might be their main encounter with Steve for the week. Others, however, knew to expect rigorous follow-ups. The pressure was intense. Their past successes had earned them a place in the room, but Steve didn't care about the past. "With Steve," says Ed Catmull, "the past can be a lesson, but the past is gone." His question was always, "What are we going to do moving forward?" That's why "that's shit" was as common a response from Steve as a pointed question or a thoughtful discussion. He wanted smart answers, and he didn't want to waste time on niceties when it was simpler to be clear, no matter how critical his response. "The reason you sugarcoat things is that you don't want anyone to think you're an asshole. So that's vanity," explains Johnny Ive, a crisply articulate Brit with the muscled frame of a boxer and a tendency to hunch forward over a table as he leans in to speak to you. As design chief, Ive was on the receiving end of Steve's blunt criticisms as much as anyone. Whenever he felt abused, he would tell himself that someone who sugarcoats his true opinions might not really even be all that concerned about the other person's feelings. He just doesn't want to appear to be a jerk. But if he really cared about the work, he would be less vain and would talk directly about the work. That's the way Steve was. That's why he'd say, "That's shit." But then the next day, or the day after, he also would just as likely come back saying, "Johnny, I've been thinking a lot about what you showed me, and I think it's very interesting after all. Let's talk about it some more." Steve put it this way: "You hire people who are better than you are at certain things, and then make sure they know that they need to tell you when you're wrong." The executive teams at Apple and Pixar are constantly arguing with each other. Everybody wears their thoughts on their sleeves at Pixar. Everybody's totally straight with what they think, and the same is beginning to happen at Apple. His inner circle understood that Steve's acerbic criticism wasn't personal. They'd all learned how to, as Susan Barnes said, get through the yelling to the reason for the yelling. Steve expected them to do that, and he expected them to push back when he was wrong. "I fought with him for 16 years, remembers Rubenstein. "I mean, it was almost comedic. I remember one Christmas morning, we're on the phone screaming at each other, and both of our significant others are in the background saying, 'Come on, we have to get going, get off the damn phone.' He was always screaming about something or other. Once, we were in this huge fight, and I'm standing, I think, in Target down in Cupertino, pushing my cart around buying toilet paper or whatever the hell it was, right? And Steve and I are on the phone, yelling at each other. It's just how we operate. I grew up in New York City. My family was out of a Woody Allen movie. You know that scene in Annie Hall where they're underneath the Thunderbolt roller coaster? That's my family. So fighting all the time didn't bother me. That was probably one of the reasons we were successful together." From 850 miles up the Pacific coast, Bill Gates watched with great interest as the limping company he had helped with that $150 million investment and a commitment to make software for the Mac struggled to survive. It was a much more mature group, he observes. With the Mac team, or even at Next, when Steve went on a jag, everybody just scattered into their own corner. But this Apple management team would push back and coalesce as a group. When Steve would pull any one individual out of the pack and say, "Your work is such shit and you're such an idiot," the pack had to decide, okay, are we going to let this one go or do we really like this guy? And they could go to Steve afterwards and say, "Hey, come on, there aren't that many people we can hire that are near as good as that guy. Go back and apologize." And he would, even though his intensity was still just incredible. "That is a really crack team that has gone through hell and bonded with each other in toughness," Gates continues, falling into the present tense. "I mean, you can point to everybody on that team and say, okay, he earned his pay, he earned his pay, he earned his pay. There's no weakness in that team, nor is there a backup plan or a forward-looking alternative team. It's just this one team." Steve had assembled a group that was strong enough to deal with who he was, and autonomous enough to compensate for his weaknesses. They developed their own tactics for managing him. "It was like we had a common enemy," says Rubenstein. Members of the team would meet regularly with one another to plan how to get Steve to authorize the decisions they felt would be best, to figure out a way through or around Steve's more imperious or ill-considered decisions or prejudices, and to try to anticipate where Steve would steer things next. They had the sense that Steve knew this was going on behind his back. "He knew that he could count on us to make things work," says Devanian, "even when there was friction or problems. We faced some really hard problems, you know, and he knew he could trust us to do the right thing." I watched Steve closely, both as he steadily and patiently composed his strategies and as he cajoled this stable, impressive team to execute them. I was skeptical because of his past failures as a manager, but intrigued. One day I asked him if he had come to enjoy the process of building companies, now that he was trying to do so for a third time. No, he started, as if I were a fool. But if he didn't enjoy building companies, he sure had a thoughtful and convincing way of describing why he kept doing it. "The only purpose for me in building a company is so that that company can make products. One is a means to the other. Over a period of time, you realize that building a very strong company and a very strong foundation of talent and culture in a company is essential to keep making great products. The company is one of the most amazing inventions of humans, this abstract construct that's incredibly powerful. Even so, for me, it's about the products. It's about working together with really fun, smart, creative people and making wonderful things. It's not about the money. What a company is, then, is a group of people who can make more than just the next big thing. It's a talent, it's a capability, it's a culture, it's a point of view, and it's a way of working together to make the next thing, and the next one, and the next one. A talent, a capability, a culture, and a point of view. The Apple he was in the midst of recreating would have all these things, as would the products it would create. Steve knew he had to deliver Apple's first new product in 1998. He certainly couldn't expect Apple's millions of investors to wait around for years and years, as Perot and Cannon had been forced to do at Next. But Apple didn't have any great software applications ready to unveil, and Steve had no desire to offer any hardware that had been in the Emilio pipeline. He needed something new, and it had to have enough of his DNA to signal that serious changes were afoot. The personal computer business had been bereft of creativity and excitement for so long that it was now simply known as the box business. Steve needed a lot more than just another box. he found his answer in the skunk works of a building several blocks away from the corporate offices. That's where Johnny Ive, the designer who had so impressed Fred Anderson, was toiling away. Ive, Apple's head designer, was not yet a member of Steve's inner circle. An unassuming self-starter who turned 30 at about the time that Steve arrived in 1997, Ive had signed on with Apple as a contract designer in 1992 when he still lived in London, working for a design consultancy called Tangerine. The son of a silversmith who taught at the local college in the London suburb of Chingford, Ive gravitated toward industrial design at an early age and went on to study at what is now called Northumbria University in Newcastle. There, he became an admirer of Dieter Rams, the legendary one-time chief of design for Braun, the German small appliance maker, who in the 1970s was one of the pioneers of what is now called sustainable design, and who railed against the industrial practice of planned obsolescence. Rams, who still designs furniture for a Danish company called Vitsu, had become known for his 10 principles of good design. According to Rams, good design is 1. Innovative. 2. What makes a product useful. 3. Aesthetic. 4. What makes a product understandable. 5. Unobtrusive. 6. Honest. 7. Long-lasting. 8. Thorough down to the last detail. 9. Environmentally friendly. 10. As little design as possible. During Emilio's short tenure, I had visited Johnny in his workspace, called the Design Lab. After Steve returned, the lab would be moved into the main headquarters complex on Infinite Loop and would become as off-limits as Los Alamos during the Manhattan Project. But under Emilio, it was accessible on the late Friday afternoon when I visited. Ive was the only employee still around that day. The space was piled high with gray plastic or styrofoam mock-ups of the multitudes of previous, rather ordinary Macs he and his team had designed. Back then, his objective was to repackage computers in an artfully austere way, more than to create radically new designs. There were just two exceptions, both vivid in their own way. The first one that he showed me was the eMate, his counterintuitive version of the Newton message pad for elementary school students. The clamshell-type device really did look somewhat like a muscle. Its subtle curves gave it a playful look. But what really grabbed your eyes was its translucent aquamarine plastic shell, a throbbing color that seemed to glow as if lit from within. The other brilliant design Johnny showed me was his prototype of a limited edition machine Apple would release belatedly to commemorate the company's 20th anniversary. The 20th anniversary Macintosh was his pride and joy at the time. It was a striking piece of out-of-the-box industrial design thinking. Johnny and his team had placed the guts of a top-of-the-line laptop inside a svelte and slightly curved vertical slab, which had on the top half of its surface a color LCD monitor, and on the bottom half a vertical CD-ROM drive, all of which was framed by specially designed Bose stereo speakers. It was packed with state-of-the-art technology, including cable television and FM tuners, and the circuitry necessary for the computer to double as TV set or a radio. Finally, Ive and his team had concocted a conch-shaped floor module to house the power supply, a subwoofer, and a powerful hi-fi audio amplifier so that the computer would supply the sonic fullness of a high-powered stereo system without generating too much heat or seeming bulky. The whole package looked as if it belonged on display in the sculpture gallery of New York's Museum of Modern Art. In fact, one did wind up in the museum's industrial design section. Technivores lusted after the machines. The first time Steve made the long trek over to the design lab, Ive was nervous and apprehensive. That very first time we met, he had already started to talk about re-engaging Harmut Esslinger, the founder of Frog Design, who had designed the first Mac, Ive says. He came over to the studio, I think, essentially, to fire me. And he should have done that based on the products that we were shipping at the time, which weren't very good at all. The products and the prototypes didn't thrill Steve, but Ive himself made a bigger impression. He is quiet and earnest, and can be beguilingly engaging when describing what he is trying to accomplish with his designs, in his proper British accent. Like Steve, Johnny has a gift for clearly explaining complex ideas. Steve was impressed. "You know, Johnny, he's kind of a cherub," Steve told me in late 1997. "I liked him right away, and I could tell after that first meeting that Emilio had wasted his talent." Just as important, Johnny was impressed by Steve. Thousands of Apple employees had scattered their resumes across Silicon Valley as they tried to abandon Emilio's leaky ship, and Johnny had resolved to look around himself. But he quickly saw that Steve and Emilio couldn't have been more different. Emilio described himself as the turnaround king, Ive remembers. So he was focused on turnaround, which is mainly about not losing money. The way you don't lose money is you don't spend it. But Steve's focus was completely different, and it never changed. It was exactly the same focus from the first time I met him to right to the very end. The product. "We trust if we do a good job, and the product's good, people will like it. And we trust that if they like it, they'll buy it. If we're competent operationally, we will make money." It was that simple. So Johnny decided not to leave Apple, a choice that would lead to the closest and most fruitful creative collaboration of Steve's entire career, even more symbiotic than his original partnership with Steve Wozniak. Nonetheless, Steve killed both of Johnny's pet projects. The eMate disappeared along with all other traces of the Newton, save a few key patents, and the 20th anniversary bit the dust after selling just 12,000 units. The products didn't fit into his quadrants. "Besides," he told me one day, "I just don't like television. Apple will never make a TV again." This was Johnny's introduction to Steve's cold-hearted decision-making. Like Avi and Ruby and Fred and Tim, he had come to understand that Apple's best chance forward was with Steve, and that if you were in with Steve, you were in all the way, bumps and all. There was one thing that especially intrigued Steve at the design lab: the odd texture and eerie translucence of the eMate's plastic shell. That detail became a seed idea for the iMac, the first product of the new Steve Jobs era at Apple. Technologically, the iMac was not a radical departure from the past. But working closely with Steve, I've designed a cosmetic standout that, for the first time in years, gave the personal computer some personality. The iMac was a dramatically rounded shell made of material similar to the eMate's. Through its Bondi Blue, named for the evocative tropical waters of Bondi Beach near Sydney, Australia, translucent plastic exterior, a buyer could see the inner workings of the computer, its rigorously arranged wires and circuit boards loaded with chips that looked like 3D maps of cities. The computer and monitor were housed in a single bulbous module with a circular hatch on the back that doubled as a handle to allow access for repairs or modifications. Steve loved the handle despite its impracticality because it was a throwback to the original Mac. The machine weighed 38 pounds. So it wasn't likely that anyone would actually treat it like a laptop to be carried around from one workspace to another. But the handle, the shape, and the translucence combined to make the iMac seem like a bottle of blue fun. It was exactly the kind of hot new product he needed to once again differentiate Apple from the box crowd, the Dells and Compaqs and HPs and IBMs. Two other decisions, one technological, one driven by marketing, also made the iMac stand out from that crowd of putty-colored rectangular slabs. Steve and John Rubinstein opted for a CD-ROM drive instead of a standard floppy disk drive, despite the fact that most people at the time still stored their data on floppy disks. You could buy a separate external floppy disk drive to plug into the iMac. But Steve reasoned that most software would soon be delivered on CD-ROM optical discs, a technology that was already fast displacing vinyl and tape cassettes as the primary medium for recorded music. He also felt certain that within a year or two, recordable CD-ROM drives would render floppy disk drives redundant. As he had before, he was betting that users would accept a slightly uncomfortable move into the future, one that would force them to convert their data to a new format. This time, he got it right. Steve's other noteworthy decision was to slot the letter I in before Mac. The iMac was built to be plugged into the Internet via sockets that could handle either a phone line, or for those lucky enough to have access, a connection to a full-fledged Ethernet network. It sported a built-in telephone modem as standard equipment, while most computer makers sold those only as an optional add-on. Steve had foreseen that buyers would see this Internet Mac as a forward-looking computer with an eye toward the future of personal computing, which was clearly going to revolve around the Internet. But the eye did more than that. The eye was personal, in that this was my computer, and even perhaps an expression of who I am. And what a bold expression it was. Fresh and transparent and different. It seemed like the kind of computer that an individual who could think different would use. Many critics in the burgeoning computer press sneered that the iMac was neither faster nor more powerful than machines from its competitors. After all, for a decade, speed and power had been the only way personal computers differentiated themselves. Those same critics disliked the fact that this blue, rotund thing looked more like a toy than a computer. But they had missed the point completely. The iMac's radical design sent exactly the kind of reassuring, friendly, and differentiating message that Steve wanted to send. With one product, Apple had reinforced its position as the personal computer company. The iMac was a vivid reminder that personal computers are tools for people, and that they should both reflect and amplify an individual's own personality. That's why the iMac was an instant success, selling nearly 2 million units in the first 12 months of production, and becoming Apple's first bona fide hit in years. Its success was critical to Steve's plans for a rebound. Steve had returned to Apple believing strongly that design could be a significant part of Apple's resurrection. The iMac supported his theory. "When we did the first iMac," he later told me, "there was such resistance in hardware engineering. A lot of people thought it wasn't a Mac, that it would fail. But the minute that everybody saw it succeed in the marketplace, a lot of the people started to turn around and go, okay, this design stuff is important, I guess." They felt the thrill of success again. Steve and Johnny's iMac enabled Apple to make a bold first step toward recovery, buying Apple some precious time at a moment when most observers thought it was headed to its grave. One of Steve's great failures during his first tenure at Apple had been his inability to deliver strong sequels to the Mac, or even the Apple II. But that wasn't the case with the iMac. Just 1 year after its introduction, the company started to sell a new version in 5 gumdrop colors. They were even cooler than the Bondi Blue machines, because they came with a simple slot drive for CDs, replacing the clunkier drawer that came with the first ones. And their optimistic, brilliant colors played well into Apple's marketing, which kept redefining the Apple brand as forward-looking, lively, and creative. But Steve didn't just focus on the flashy iMacs. That, too, was a mistake the old Steve would have made. He made sure that his team did an equally excellent job filling the other 3 quadrants of the grand plan. The so-called towers as the desktop computers for professionals were known, were the machines that paid the bills. Loaded with faster chips, more memory, better graphics and slots for adding hard drives and CD burners and other accessories, the towers were engineered for power users, hence their name, the Power Mac. These big machines sat under your desk, linked to a monitor on your desktop, and were so fast that Apple marketed them as the first personal supercomputers. They were hefty, but Ive's design gave the impression that they were sleek and manageable. They even had dual handles that mimicked the iMacs, and one side that opened up to make tinkering with the innards easier. The base model cost at least $1,000 more than the iMac, but it also carried much higher profit margins. Here, too, Steve avoided a mistake Apple had made the first time around. He didn't claim that the Power Mac was the computer for all businesses, and in so doing, try to push Wintel-based PCs out of the market. Instead, he targeted the Power Macs at the new, more entrepreneurial class of small businesses emerging with the rise of the Internet economy. Engineers, architects, publishers, advertising agencies, website designers, and so on. This was a world that could tolerate and even celebrate Think Different, while the dominant class of big corporations looked on fearfully at the radical and potentially undermining change the Internet seemed to promise. The design and engineering genius that was applied to the iMacs and towers was applied to the laptops as well. The personal models, called iBooks, mimicked the fun of the iMac with a beguiling, bright orange clamshell design that echoed the shape of the old eMate. The higher-end PowerBooks for professionals were curvy, too, but they were sheathed in a rubbery-feeling black shell and powered by a PowerPC microprocessor that briefly allowed Apple to claim the somewhat dubious title of fastest laptop in the world. The cumulative effect of these revitalized iMacs was simple but profound. Just 3 years removed from near death, Apple had reestablished itself as the most, if not the only, truly creative company in the computer business. "When we returned to Apple," Steve told me around this time, "our industry was in a coma. There was not a lot of innovation. At Apple, we're working hard to get that innovation kick-started again. The rest of the PC industry reminds one of Detroit in the 70s. Their cars were boats on wheels. Since then, Chrysler innovated by inventing the minivan and popularizing the Jeep, and Ford got itself back in the game with its Taurus. Near-death experiences can help one see more clearly sometimes." The turnaround, however, did not come without expensive failures. Apple had done a good job embracing the Internet by making the process of getting access to the web as simple as any other function of an iMac. But Apple's eWorld, a proprietary online subscription service bundled with new iMacs, was a flop. Despite a friendly interface that suggested that going online could be as easy as walking from one neighborhood to the next, all it really offered was email services and a way to download software. And in practice, it wasn't any easier to use than bigger services like Earthlink and AOL, which came bundled on Wintel PCs. A costlier failure was a pet project that Ruby and Steve worked on together and argued about endlessly, the so-called Power Mac Cube, which was introduced in 2000. Harking back to the design of the next cube, but 1/8 the size, Apple's G4 Cube was such a stunning, clean design that it too wound up in the Museum of Modern Art. Unfortunately, it didn't wind up in many homes or offices. Steve loved the Cube. It packed a lot of power, although not quite enough to qualify as a true power user's computer, into a translucent cube just 7 inches by 7 inches all around. Its cables plugged into Apple's first super-wide flat-screen monitor for the desktop. My monitor measured 25 inches diagonally, and it rested on my office desk next to the cube like a minimalist sculpture. But in this case, Steve made similar mistakes to ones he made at Next, He overlooked some of the engineering idiosyncrasies necessitated by the Stark design he loved. Worse yet, the cube seemed snakebit by a host of manufacturing problems. Its clear plastic shell cracked on many machines, a flaw that ruined what had seemed a design masterpiece. My cube never cracked, but the monitor developed its own strange aesthetic problem. Ants and other insects were somehow attracted to squeeze through seams in the clear plastic frame that surrounded the screen, and once inside, they couldn't get out. Over time, the two transparent feet of the screen filled up with bug carcasses. But the effect was not as pleasing as when a prehistoric fly is trapped in amber. I teased Steve about the bug-friendly screen he'd developed a couple of times, but he never found it all that amusing. He pulled the plug on the cube early, and it never sold anything near the numbers he had forecast. Steve had surrounded himself with a mature, experienced, and disciplined team, made up of people who could argue back fiercely. And for once, he allowed them significant authority. Apple was simply too big for him to make all the decisions himself. Gradually, the organization developed in a way that allowed him to get the details he needed without micromanaging those areas of the company where he added a lot less. He primarily managed through his inner circle, although he convened meetings of the top 100 people from time to time. And the Monday morning executive team meeting became the linchpin of the week. His attempt to delegate worked well, for the most part. In matters of finance, for instance, I would get him involved when I needed him, remembers Anderson. Steve was trying to keep his fingers on the pulse of a growing company without stifling it. He also liked having a confidant, someone he could banter with outside the formal line's responsibility of daily corporate life. In the early years of Steve's return, Mike Slade served that function. Slade, by his own admission, isn't any kind of creative genius, like Lee Clow or Woz, but he had lots of real-world experience. He spoke his mind, and was both easygoing and independent enough to engage in spirited repartee with Steve without any qualms. He also had made it clear he did not want an executive position at Apple, which made it easier for him to have a good personal relationship with Steve. They would sometimes jog together in the early morning, and he even went rollerblading with Steve and Loreen. Slade showed up in Cupertino on Mondays and Tuesdays, flying down from Seattle. No one reported to him, and Steve had told the group that he had no particular authority. But when he was at Apple, he almost never left Steve's side. Their Mondays would begin with the executive management team meeting. After that, the two would usually go eat in the cafeteria, and later venture into the design lab. Slade tried to participate in their discussions. Johnny would say stuff like, "Steve, I'm not sure the design language and the way it's joining with this is quite right." "What do you think?" says Slade, laughing. And I'm going, "Yeah, it's cool. Can I have a Coke now?" They'd ask me, "Do you think we've got the right degree of opacity?" And all I can think is, "Why am I here?" Of course, Slade knew more than he'll admit. But his sense of humor and realism appealed to Steve. Steve didn't allow himself to relax with his inner circle the way he would with Slade. Slade was the court jester, says Ruby, who also became good friends with Slade over the years. Most Mondays, their visit to IVE would be followed by one to Avi and the team working on Apple's new operating system, which would eventually be called OS X. The radical new operating system would be the flywheel of all the extraordinary developments that would follow over the next decade, from Apple's suite of iLife applications to iOS, the slimmed-down operating system that would give life to the iPhone and iPad, to the entirely new software industry that emerged to produce the millions of apps written for those devices. While Steve's gadgets and computers drew the most attention, the software that made them go was every bit as important. Steve always said that Apple's primary competitive advantage was that it created the whole widget, a finely tuned symbiosis between the hardware and the software together, defined a superior user experience. In the PC world, hardware and software technologies came from different companies that didn't always even get along, including IBM and the PC clone manufacturers, Microsoft, and Intel. Without a new operating system that could outshine Windows, the revival of the Macintosh could never be complete. The existing one was based on technology that had been developed 15 years earlier for the original Mac, and the look and feel on the screen had come to seem passé. Back at Next, Avi had developed a version of Unix that presented a friendlier face to non-technical users, while also retaining its bona fides as a serious, world-class computing environment. There, too, the goal had been to create the whole widget. So he designed it to dovetail nicely with the Next Cube. But when the company was forced to refocus solely on software, Avi and his team knew that the only way they could sell the Next OS was to make it attractive to users of workstations made by other manufacturers, like Sun, IBM, or Sony, and perhaps even to users of standard PCs. That's why they had created experimental working versions on Sun workstations using Spark microprocessors, on other personal computers and engineering workstations using Intel's best Pentium PC microprocessors, and even on the PowerPC chip that was now the heart of Apple's latest Macintoshes. This experience of porting Next OS to other machines would pay off in two ways for Apple. For starters, Tavanian and his crew walked in the door at Cupertino with the code base and the know-how to support the troubled company no matter which microprocessor would be at the core of future Macintoshes. Apple had already switched Macintosh microprocessors once before, and Steve wanted the flexibility to do so again if it made sense. Since his old Next programmers had learned the technological idiosyncrasies of several computing platforms, they could help him make a much more objective decision when it came time to switch again. Technologically agnostic, they would push for the architecture that would get the most out of their operating system. In other words, the one that would help them build the best whole widget possible. This was an ace up Steve's sleeve, one he would play to great effect several years down the road. Second, and more immediately important, the travails at Next had turned Tavanian's crew into a first-rate team. The primary task they faced was to turn the Next operating system into something that remained robust, but had a modernized look and feel that bore enough similarity to the original Apple system for Mac users to migrate over with as little discomfort as possible. Another priority was to preserve compatibility with software applications that ran on the old Mac OS 9, at least in the short run. Finally, they had to build tools for software developers to help them adapt their old applications to OS X, or even rewrite them altogether to take full advantage of its capabilities. The challenges in developing any new operating system are many and varied. And even though OS X was essentially a modified version of a proven existing operating system, the Appleization of it was still an enormous job. Steve understood this, and he didn't create unreasonable deadlines for his programmers. Instead, he oversaw them with a mix of patience and impatience that allowed him to be forceful and yet respectful. What eventually resulted was an operating system that mixed the best of Steve's intuitive understanding of the needs of regular people with deep, robust, and flexible code written by some of the greatest programmers in the world. It preserved the winsome on-screen personality that had made Apple customers so loyal through thick and thin. Steve was particularly obsessed with the operating system's look and feel. In the afternoon OS X meetings that Slade would attend with Steve, each of Avi's direct reports would be admitted into a locked conference room to demonstrate the latest developments on whatever aspect of OS X they were handling. "We went over OS X again and again," remember Slade, "pixel by pixel, feature by feature, screen by screen. Should the genie effect look like this? How big should the dock icons magnify? What's the type style? Why does this dial look the way it does? Every week, the agenda was to get Steve to approve the look and feel of each item. There is nothing in the operating system that he didn't approve, continues Slade. It was the opposite of how things were done at Microsoft, where they relied on these 500-page specs, documents laying out in detail every feature to be created by the software developers. We had specs, too, but Steve never looked at them. He just looked at the product. When Steve saw something he didn't like, he would tell a user interface designer by the name of Boss Ording to mock it up the way he wanted it. Boss was a wizard, says Slade. He'd take 90 seconds pecking away, he'd hit a button, and there it was. A picture of whatever Steve had asked for. The guy was a god. Steve just laughed about it. Bossification in progress, he'd announce. What made the OS X development even harder was ensuring that the new operating system wouldn't instantly render users' old applications useless. This backwards compatibility is one of the most difficult challenges a computer company can face. It was a real problem for Apple back in the early 1980s, when Apple II customers found that their software didn't work particularly well on an Apple III. Steve believed that Apple's consumers would adapt more easily than conventional wisdom suggested, since they were far more enthusiastic about their Macs than Microsoft's customers were about their PCs. He believed they would be quite willing to make a big leap to a new operating system, even if it also required eventually buying all new hardware and software. And he was right. Over the next decade, in its quest to keep the OS lean and modern, Apple would slowly stop supporting for a variety of carryover features from previous generations of hardware and software that were dearly beloved by a sometimes vocal minority. Most Mac customers figured the trade-offs involved in a steadily improving computer platform were worth it, however. Still, Steve and Avi did everything they could to make the transition to OS X as benign as possible for customers. One thing they exploited was a new way of delivering software updates. With more and more computers constantly connected to the web, Apple could update user software frequently by delivering improvements, modifications, and bug fixes directly over the internet. This applied not just to operating system software, but to all manner of applications, and made sense both for the customers and for the software developers, who by nature love to continue tweaking their work once it is finished. Avi and his team were among the first mainstream operating system developers to take full advantage of this capability. And their approach would change the expectations of hundreds of millions of people, from corporate IT managers all the way down to the individual smartphone user who wants the very latest version of his favorite game. Indeed, when Apple first released OS X in September 2000, the company called it a public beta version, implying that it was a work in progress. The price was $29.95, about a fifth of what was typically charged for a significant operating system upgrade. It was shrewd marketing, because it implied that early adopters would effectively be putting OS X through a shakedown cruise, and thus some bugs and glitches were to be expected. It also gave Apple a test period during which it could work out how to manage those online software upgrades. And during that period, Avi's team used the internet to provide numerous updates that improved the software. This way of maintaining and fixing software would quickly become the industry norm. It also transformed customers' expectations. No longer would they be willing to wait months for their software providers to fix a problem. Given the breathing room that the success of the iMac had bought them, the Unix core upon which they built their system and their own coding expertise, Avi and his programmers had been able to shoot for the moon. So when OS X was finally ready to go, it could make the Mac do things no PC had ever been able to do. Users reveled in the obvious cosmetic improvements, like the ability to have video continue to play even as you used a mouse to move a window around the screen. And OS X was truly beautiful to behold, creating a screen with the illusion of three dimensions, where windows appeared to cast shadows on the layers of objects behind them. It still ran most old Mac programs, especially when their makers made a few slight modifications that could be downloaded and installed easily. But underneath it all was Unix, the core operating system that geeks love to tweak. With OS X, then, Apple finally had a genuinely industrial-strength computing framework. Macs crashed far less than Wintel PCs. A single haywire program wouldn't take down the whole system. The machines seemed almost immune to software viruses, and its basic file system was easy to navigate and gave users the choice of three different ways to view and locate files in a list format. Under the hood, OS X was the state-of-the-art software foundation for everything Steve would want to create in the years ahead. As Ruby said, the mission had been to save Apple, and in early 2000, it seemed by just about every measure available that Steve and the team had accomplished that goal. They had rebuilt and revived the company's suite of computers. They were starting to provide users with a solid and modern software foundation. Morale was high, and a sense of mission had been restored. Most important, Steve had visibly changed for the better as a leader and as a manager. Over the 3.5 years since his return, he had come to recognize that taking this more incremental approach to computer development can result in the kind of equilibrium that allows you to build a business designed to thrive over the long haul. Or so it seemed. In September 2000, Apple posted a dismal earnings report. Despite all these new products and fresh technology, the company's sales continued to shrink. The stock price tumbled, falling from $63 in early September to $15 by the end of the year. Meager sales of the Cube were just the most obvious disappointment, but sales were stagnant across the board. It was beginning to look as if Steve had pushed the technology of personal computing just about as far as it could go. He had righted the ship, patched up Emilio's holes, and gotten everyone rowing in the right direction. Apple was profitable again. But to complete Apple's turnaround, he would have to get back to the business of creating new kinds of products, the kind that puncture the equilibrium of an industry and create new business opportunities. Yet now, at the end of fiscal year 2000, Apple's quarterly sales were less than when he'd arrived. And most of the gains shareholders had enjoyed since he returned had evaporated. As the headline of one of my fortune stories put it, he was the graying prince of a shrinking kingdom. Something would have to change. Chapter 10. Following Your Nose. It was Bill Gates who first mapped out the future of Apple. He did so on January 5, 2000, at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, Nevada. Of course, he'd intended to lay out a game plan for Microsoft, not Apple. But that's not the way things worked out. CES was an up-and-coming trade show back then. For years, it had been the gathering point for people making everything from car speakers to stereo systems to televisions, from electronic football games that beeped as you pushed the buttons to video cameras to home security systems. The arrival of computer companies transformed the event, and within a few years, it would become the largest digital technology exposition of them all, drawing audiences upwards of 150,000, and all but paralyzing Sin City for a week each January. Apple didn't attend CES. Steve preferred to announce his products in an environment he controlled. Microsoft didn't control CES, but it certainly overshadowed everyone else. Chairman Gates, who relinquished his CEO title to Steve Ballmer in 2000, gave the keynote speech, 8 years running. Gates was a natural choice as the show's semi-permanent celebrity speaker, and he used the dais as a bully pulpit. In 2000, Microsoft really was the computer industry. Some 90% of the world's personal computers ran its Windows operating system. Its software managed not only desktop and laptop PCs, but also the servers that stored and organized the data of the world's biggest corporations, and that undergirded the information technology of most governmental bureaucracies. Inside ATMs and cash registers, at airline check-in counters, and on the decks of aircraft carriers, Microsoft software made the world's most sophisticated technologies hum. If the consumer electronics universe was about to be thrown into turmoil, who better to hear from than the leader of the industry doing the disrupting? That evening, Gates spoke to a standing-room-only crowd of more than 3,000 people at the Las Vegas Hilton Theater, where he revealed how Microsoft would usher in the Consumer Electronics Plus era. PCs running the Windows operating system would become the central component of home media centers that would harness the Internet and interact with consumer devices and even household appliances, all loaded with Microsoft software. This would be a bonanza for consumers, he explained, because they would now get personalized, convenient access to their favorite music, news, entertainment, family photos, and email through an array of consumer electronics, including televisions, telephones, home and car stereos, and pocket PCs. The speech was a forecast, a warning, and a blueprint. Gates posited a vision of what the home would look like after the realization and interweaving of a set of trends. There would be much more connectivity among devices, access to a new range of digital content and programming via the Internet, newly interactive video games played at home, and gizmos with responsive screens and software smarts to replace mere electronic gadgets with push buttons. This is what we are going to do to your world, Gates was telling the manufacturers of consumer electronics. It is coming whether you like it or not, because this is what digital technology does to an industry. So get on board, you old-timers tinkering with microwave ovens and car stereos and televisions and headphones. Here's how you can fit into your own future, which actually belongs to us. Such was Microsoft's power at that moment, as the unquestioned ruler of the empire of computing. The company had so thoroughly infiltrated and then controlled every aspect of the world's defining digital technology that it seemed obvious to most everyone attending CES that if this was the future Microsoft wanted, this was the future. The obvious implication that Gates left unsaid was that this would be an enormous bonanza for Microsoft, which, by establishing the specifications that all kinds of hardware manufacturers would need to follow, would ensure its own dominance in the next brave new world. Ruling the market for new consumer electronics devices might have solved Gates's biggest problem. The fact that Microsoft was no longer growing at the galloping 25%+ pace investors like to see in a tech company. Remember that when Bill and Steve got into the business, computing still belonged to the IBMs and DECs of the world, with their big expensive machines sold into a market consisting of a few hundred corporations, governments, and universities. As Moore's Law drove prices down, PC manufacturers sold their wares to a galaxy of other businesses, both big and small, that could now afford powerful computing that would make them more efficient. But numerically speaking, the biggest potential audience of all was relatively untapped. Once you can sell computing to consumers directly, and once you get computing into products that become part of their everyday lives, the volumes become transformative. Consider this. According to researchers at the Gartner Group, 355 million personal computers, servers, desktop PCs, and laptops were sold around the world in 2011. Some 1.8 billion cell phones were sold the same year. And that's a number that doesn't include all the other kinds of computing-based or networkable devices that might become part of a consumer's life, including video game consoles, audio players, radios, thermostats, car navigation systems, and anything else that can become smarter through the power of connected computing. Gates, who is perhaps the world's shrewdest business strategist, saw this future coming. And he expected Microsoft to garner the same slice of this world that it had of the computing world.